all will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of things will be well. I've had a hard time believing that of late. I'm not used to being sick, and I think that the world, or at least a part of it over which I have some measure of control, will not function properly unless I am 100% in charge of 100% of everything. I don't think things will go well without my involvement. Well, having cancer become an active participant in my life turns out to be a dramatic learning experience for me. I'm beginning to learn that large parts of the world can do very, very well without my personal involvement. It's amazing, but true. Of course, this is true largely because of the cadre of wonderfully dedicated and loving people who care deeply about the church and about me. But it appears to be the case in other parts of my life as well. So I'm left pretty much thinking about me and my health. It's a new experience. I don't enjoy it, but it's the right thing to do at this point. A truth that I have known for some time, but that has come into clearer focus of late, is that a positive lifestyle is not only healthy, but healing as well. For me, a positive lifestyle involves taking care of myself by trying to maintain a good regimen of healthy foods and exercise, and being a participant in active community with others. There are millions of words written about health and healing. I can't begin to absorb them all. But I knew what I wanted to think about today concerned my personal health, and perhaps help you a bit along the way as well. So I'll run through my file of newspaper clippings, which I've assiduously gathered for years and years. And I came up with three topics that seemed to help. They were all from the Boston Globe. Two of them were editorials, and the third was an article entitled Seeing How the Spirit Moves Us, Scientists Explores Elevation. The Boston Globe editorial from July of 1997 argued that there is a cure for the common cold. It's simple as a smile, apparently, they said. According to a report in the Journal of the American Medical Association, the antidote to the clogged head is an open mind and a gregarious personality seeking involvement with as many different people and as many different realms as possible. The report went on to say that it's not the actual number of people, but rather the different types of relationships that matter. Those people in the study who had a relationship with a spouse, parent, child, friend, coworker, neighbor, or member of a religious organization were better able to fight off colds than those people who were less social. The key was variety, not quantity. The person who knew dozens of colleagues at work, for instance, did not have the immunity of the person who had only three or four relationships, but who moved in a wider circle to form them. Some people may find this line of reasoning counterintuitive. The key to good health is avoiding contact with people, especially during cold and flu season. But staying out of crowds is not the same as staying in touch with individuals. You know there is a distinctly different feeling in being in a crowd, say, in the coffee hour after church in the dining room, or being in the crowd in a department store the weekend before Christmas. We have a relationship with the other folks in our dining room, and it is crowded. There's a lot of people there. But in a congregation of this size, it's constantly adding new people. Unless you are on the membership committee or you're Sherry, you probably don't know everyone. But in the afterglow of the service, we have a shared relationship, a shared understanding, a shared religious experience. It's a healthy feeling. Generally, there is no shared relationship with other Christmas shoppers other than frustrated frenzy, not healthy. I believe that close relationships are healthy. But I, along with many others, are getting more and more concerned about the increasingly rapid decline of personal contact. My family is really tired of hearing what I'm going to tell you about next, but I don't think you've heard about it. So I've been interested for some time in the way that modern technological developments have changed the way we interact with each other. Let me be upfront about this. Most of this following discussion is my personal opinion, based on very little research. It's likely that I have dates and times and sequences wrong. But it's really of no matter, because I'm not trying to be so historically accurate as I am to show you how human interaction has changed over time. And I think that transportation, at least, is an entertaining way of following these changes. According to one report, our humanoid ancestors began walking around on this earth some 3 or 4 million years ago. I would guess that sometime after that, we also began to interact with each other. I don't pretend to know very much about history from that time, but I can imagine that the interactions probably started with some version of hunting or gathering or some interactions related to survival. Pretty basic communication, but a community of sorts. I understand that for the next 4 million years or so, we walked around, either separately or together. But we walked around, all more or less on the same level, all more or less going the same speed. As civilization advanced, so I assume did the interaction of our fellow ancestral walkers as well. There was ample opportunity to see each other face to face, catch up on the day's news, interact with the important and the regular day-to-day things of life. This went on for several million years as our ancestors developed. One resource I consulted showed that horses were tamed about 9,000 years ago. People began using them as draft animals for agriculture and also for transportation. This put those people on horseback, physically separated and higher than those who were walking. They went faster and farther than their counterparts still on foot. The people on horseback could interact with the others also on horseback, but not so well with the walkers. I imagine, though, there was still significant interaction. So for the next 8,900 years or so, that was the way it was. Then history took off at an amazing speed, thanks to the introduction of a horseless carriage, the automobile. While different versions of cars were being made for several hundreds of years, it wasn't until the 1800s that they were made in any significant numbers. Henry Ford sold the first Model T on October 1st, 1908, and auto manufacturing took off. Those first cars were open, but the passengers were moved away from physical contact with other humans. There was little opportunity to speak with each other, other than to wave as the carriage went past others, but people could still see each other face to face. They could shout out greetings as they rumbled down the road. I can remember, not so long ago, when our cars were not air-conditioned. Some very fancy cars, like Packards and Cadillacs, had air-conditioning, but not the cars we owned. We drove around in the summer with the car windows open. I remember one particularly embarrassing incident with warm soda and opening the can as it spurted into the car next to us. It was awful. There was interaction. Limited, but we interacted. Then, even the kinds of cars that we owned had air conditioning. We now ride around with the windows shut. Then cars had AC and tinted windows. The interactions are pretty much limited to when we had to stop and ask for direction. And now, we have AC, tinted windows, and GPS. No more interaction with people, only the onboard computer. What have we done? Well, one of the things we've done is we've gone back to walking. But do we walk around interacting with our fellow walkers? Some do, but most have iPods or other headphones or cellular phones demanding our attention. What have we done? I get the Daily Borowitz report delivered to my computer every morning. Andy Borowitz has a unique perspective on the news. Here's what he recently had to say about the possible future of the iPod. At company headquarters in Cupertino, California, Apple Computer CEO Steve Jobs introduced a new iPod so tiny that it can be implanted directly into the human brain. The iPod Micro T, the new Model T, becomes fused to the central nervous system through a simple, non-invasive surgical procedure that can be performed in any doctor's office or at an Apple store. While Mr. Jobs said that as many as 100 million Americans could be hardwired for sound by 2008, Sony Corporation CEO Sir Howard Stringer served to notice that his company was rolling out a new super tiny PlayStation-marked portable TV that could also be implanted directly into the brain. There's lots of room in the average American's head, and we intend to fight for every square inch of it. Sir Howard told the reporter. Okay, that's a joke, but you know, who knows? Two more personal observations about human interaction. Last summer, I was walking down Boylston Street, Boston, during lunchtime. And during the summer, many of those restaurants put tables out on the sidewalk, you know, and folks can have lunch. Now, at one restaurant, I saw three tables, and each of those three tables, there were two people. All six of those people had on those sunglasses, you know, the kind that are reflective so you can't see the eyes. Okay. So all six of them had on those reflective sunglasses. Each one of those tables, one of the people was on the cell phone. Okay. I also noticed none of them were touching each other, weren't holding hands or anything. So you would assume that when you go to lunch with somebody, there'd be some sort of interaction. All three of those couples weren't interacting. They couldn't see each other, they were talking to somebody else, and they weren't touching. And they were all within, you know, this much distance of each other. Also last summer, I spent a week at yoga camp at Ferry Beach. On several of those mornings, I walked down from my tent in the camping grove to the beach to watch the sun come up. If you're familiar with Ferry Beach, you know that it's a several mile long beach. On those mornings, I joined four or five other early risers to watch the sun appear over the horizon. Those were holy moments. And although each of us was separated across several miles, we were united in that sacred time. The second Boston Globe editorial that I found was from 2004, and it says, "Sunrise is a drama that never grows stale, even though human beings have seen it for millions of years. People who have taken comfort in the dawn through the millennia discover a meditation that lifts one beyond the immediate audience and connects one with the whole human family. Watching the sunrise is an act of faith in the future, knowing that no matter the turmoil, calm will return. That is the promise of every new day." The French philosopher Michel Eliade has argued that as science, technology, and the industrial age have progressed, the Western world has become less sacred. His important work is entitled The Sacred and the Profane. By the word profane, Eliade means ordinary, not sacred. He shows that all humans share the perception of the sacred. Even atheists have touches with the sacred. He notes that everyone has privileged places that are qualitatively different from all others. A man's birthplace or the scene of his first love, I would add sunrises. Even for the most frankly non-religious person, all these places still retain a unique quality. They are the person's holy places. Even atheists have intimations of sacredness, particularly when in love or in nature. They just don't infer that God caused these feelings. Eliade further correctly points out that the modern West is the first culture in human history that has managed to strip time and space of all sacredness and to produce a fully practical, efficient, and profane world. "The world is too much with us," wrote William Wordsworth. "Late and soon, getting and spending, we may waste our powers. Little we see in nature that is ours. We have given our hearts away, a sordid boon. The sea that bears her bosom to the moon. The winds that will be howling at all hours are upgathered now, like sleeping flowers. For this, for everything, we are out of tune. We are out of tune with nature. We have wandered away from what is good and healthy. We need to get back in touch with each other and with our world." The third clipping I found in my file It's about a social psychologist, Jonathan Haidt, who spent a lot of time thinking about the way we are in the world and how we could be better at it. Haidt's basic promise is that up to this point, most psychological research has been concerned with what is wrong with people rather than what is right. Listen to this. He himself studied disgust for 8 years. Before it even occurred to him to ask about the opposite of disgust. He decided, because he knew disgust so well, he was able to figure out what the opposite was, and he calls it elevation. He says there's only six basic emotions, and elevation wants to add as a seventh one. An emotion triggered by people behaving in a virtuous, pure, or superhuman way. He goes on to describe elevation as how people feel when they perform acts of generosity or goodness, and interestingly, how they feel when they witness others doing good or virtuous things. He found that while psychologists had almost nothing to say about elevation, Oprah Winfrey and others in the popular press had a lot to say about it, how people were touched, loved, inspired by goodness. People tend to have physical reactions. You probably have experienced this yourself, feeling warmth in the chest or the heart area. They tend to cry, and they are more likely to report wanting to help others, to become better people themselves, and to affiliate with others, to be in community. We have to start living our lives like this. Many of us do. Many of you do. I know. I have been the recipient recently of your own warm generosity of love and cards and flowers and phone calls and emails. That's what we Unitarian Universalists do very, very well. I found myself being drawn into Haidt's work when he mentioned two Unitarians prominently in his new book. Well, one we think might have been a Unitarian, Thomas Jefferson, but we claim him anyway. The second person Haidt describes is definitely a Unitarian Universalist and a member of the Arlington Mass UU Church. He quotes Jefferson, who in 1771 said, "Everything is useful which contributes to fix us in the principles and practice of virtue. When any act of charity or of gratitude is presented to us, we are deeply impressed with its beauty and feel a strong desire in ourselves of doing charitable and grateful acts. Our breasts are dilated and our sentiments elevated." Haidt says the goal of positive psychology is to bring about a balanced reappraisal of human nature and human potential. We can grant that people are capable of perpetrating great cruelty upon one another. But we also must grant these study the ways in which people are good and kind and compassionate toward one another. To learn more about this, Haidt and his team did several years of research. And the most perfect example came from David Whitford, a member of the Arlington Mass Unitarian Universalist Church. The congregation had done a study group where the participants were asked to write their spiritual autobiography. Mr. Whitford sent the research team a section of his autobiography in which he puzzled over why he was so often moved to tears during the course of church services. He noticed that there were two kinds of tears. The first one he calls tears of compassion, such as those he sheds during a sermon about children who grow up abandoned or neglected. These cases felt to him like being pricked in the soul, after which love pours out for those who are suffering. But the second kind of tears are very different. He calls them tears of celebration, but he could just as well have called them tears of elevation. These tears are less about giving love and more about the joy of receiving love, or maybe just detecting love, whether it's directed at me or someone else. It's kind of tears that flow in response to expressions of courage or compassion or kindness by others. Whitford reported that one Sunday, the congregation met in the sanctuary to consider whether or not to become a welcoming congregation, like this church did in 1998. When a man stood in support of the resolution and spoke up how, as far as he knew, He was the first gay man to come out at First Parish in the early 1970s. David reports, "I cried for his courage." Later, when all hands went up and the resolution passed unanimously, "I cried for the love expressed by our congregation in that act." Those were tears of celebration, tears of receptiveness to what is good in the world. Tears that it's okay, relax, let down your guard. There are good people in the world. There is good in people. Love is real. It's in our nature. Those kinds of tears were also like being pricked, only now the love pours in. We know about that. We know about elevation and health and healing and being held in loving community. And we know that all will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of things will be well. Please join us now in our closing hymn.